Rewind is a production of Wisconsin Eye. To keep programs like this free and accessible to all, please consider a charitable gift to wiseye.org/donate or text WISEYE to 44321. This program is brought to you from Wisconsin Eye's Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. The political fight over how to spend millions to fight the opioid epidemic has come to an end. Plus, a Waukesha County judge rules clerks can no longer fill in missing information on absentee ballots, how the decision could impact voters. And Governor Evers is putting education at the top of his list for his reelection bid. We'll tell you how much he wants to spend on K-12 schools in the next state budget. All this and more on Rewind, your week in review for September 9th.
Hi, I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
J.R., we're going to start with a political feud over opioid settlement funds came to a close on Thursday. Now, the backstory about this is last month, DHS proposed how they want to spend $31 million in those opioid settlement funds, but Republicans didn't really approve of their plan. There was a one committee member that objected to it, so the funds were not released yet. On Thursday, Republicans kind of proposed their own one, which reflected about 85% of DHS's plan, but it did take away funding from certain areas that Dems were a little upset about, you could say. Let's first just take a listen to the reasoning of why Republicans waited a few weeks to revise this plan, and we'll kind of get into the details of where the funding will go next.
Once again, we saw the Evers administration, and particularly the Department of Health, fail with a half-baked plan. There was a lack of details. There was a lack of clear working with stakeholders, like the ones here today and others, on what's important to this state as we deal with this opioid epidemic that challenges all of our communities. There was no direct work with our public safety partners. We know as legislative Republicans that law enforcement and our public safety folks are the boots on the ground, as the sheriff talked about, that are key in this. So we are proud to add that today. Unfortunately, Josh Call and Tony Evers continues to turn their back on law enforcement and does not want to work with these key people in public safety in our communities. Legislative Republicans will always stand with them, and that's an important part of today's plan.
So let's bring up that full screen again to compare the proposals, because the biggest changes in here, JR, is that Republicans wanted to spend $3 million on law enforcement grants, so law enforcement, you know, can fight the opioid epidemic, and also $75,000 for community organizations and $1 million for what's called hub and spoke, basically their substance abuse program. So there was a little bit of disagreement, but in the end result, all lawmakers unanimously passed this on joint finance on Thursday, and seems like it's a done deal now.
Yeah, and all they moved about $5.75 million. The biggest cuts that they made, kind of cuts to the governor's plan, were one, the governor wanted to put $2 million into education, K-12 education, for kind of an anti-abuse type message, curriculum. They cut that down to about $250,000. Then there would be family centers, basically where people who have a family member who's struggling with addiction could go for help. They cut that $2 million, period. Those are kind of the biggest changes there. Perhaps the most kind of gripping part of the hearing was John Erpenbach, a Democrat from Western Dane County, or actually north of Dane County now, talking about his own struggles. His daughter, 27, her struggle with addiction, how he can't find he gets answers, he says, but they're different answers from different people, and how these centers could really help families. He urged the committee, please don't stop. Don't let this be it. Help these families do more later on. Shannon Zimmerman, Republican from up northwestern Wisconsin, talked about his sister, how she has struggled losing job opportunities because he said we need to work on helping people who've struggled with addiction, with reintegration, as he called it, to get into these things, get past this. So there's more work to be done. But this has been a rub between the governor and Republicans because they say he didn't talk to the right people. The gov's office says, well, we talked to 800 people. So which is it? Are they just talking to different people? What's going on? It's also a rub where there's not a lot of communication between Republican lawmakers and the Evers administration. Now, the co-chairs, Mark Bourne and Howard Markline, said that they met with DHS about things, but they couldn't get enough answers to satisfy their questions about what they wanted. They wanted more details. Again, Evan Goyke, Democrat in the committee, said this is the silly season, we call it, in politics. It's all about politics and driving a message. Let's get this done and move past it. So we'll see what goes on forward. We got $31 million split between for the state in this package. That drops to $18 million in calendar year 23, so less money to fight over. It'll be, I think, split between the state and local governments, $18 million. So this is part of a 17-year settlement, so much more to come, but we'll see this conversation again, I'm going to bet you, next year.
And, of course, anything when it comes to litigation has to be approved of how that spending is spent by the Joint Finance Committee. So if there are other litigations, I know there was just a Juul settlement that the Attorney General just announced. If that starts happening, maybe there might be another political happenings going on with that committee of Republicans not approving how the Evers administration wants to spend that money. I think we've often seen these in headlines. They usually get settled, and then we move on. And I think it's definitely an issue that we could possibly see bipartisanship down the road. It seemed like there was a consensus that, yes, maybe we don't agree on how to spend this money individually. There's more work to be done, like you said, in the future and in the state budget and investing in fighting the opioid epidemic. Now we're going to move on to a lot of election news this week as well, JR. We're first going to start with the Wisconsin Elections Commission approved guidance with voters with disabilities. Now, they had to do this and meet after a lower court, said basically you got to clean up the rules of basically, a federal judge ruled that disabled voters should be able to get assistance when returning their absentee ballot because many of them can't physically put it in the mailbox or drive to their local clerk's office. Let's hear a little bit from the judge's ruling, or excuse me, from the WEC Commission. And an issue here is that Republicans really just wanted some type of certification. They wanted some proof if I go drop off a ballot or multiple ballots for individuals with disabilities, that I have to show proof that they gave me permission to do this. That ultimately was shot down, but let's just hear from both sides about that and we'll dive more into this.
I don't see there's any basis in the law, and I think it would be inconsistent with the finding and the ruling of the court that we have to follow the Voting Rights Act. He didn't say come up with hurdles and make it harder for disabled voters to vote, or make it harder for their those that they ask to assist them. This is just, I mean, one is it's inconsistent with the federal court's holding. It's inconsistent with federal law. And we are inviting another lawsuit tomorrow morning if we do this.
And I think this puts almost none pressure or extra burden on the person that we should be concerned in, and that is the voter. And all we're asking is that the person that's bringing it in, and if everything is legit, I seriously doubt that somebody that's bringing in the ballot or ballots or whatever is going to have a problem certifying. And whether it's in the statutes or not, we talked about that before. We have the ability to put some restrictions on to keep the integrity of the election going forward. So I think I don't see that as a problem at all. I think it's a good solution to try and solve, and it's the best solution for the people of Wisconsin, as far as I can see.
There was also an offer of basically maybe limiting how many ballots people can collect. That ended up being dismissed as well. So there was a lot of ideas out there during this meeting, and eventually it's pretty straightforward. Any people can help someone with disabilities collect their ballots and return it to the clerk's office.
So there are two Republican motions. Remember, it's a commission split 3-3 among Dem and Republican appointees. The first Republican motion was that if you either mail a ballot for somebody, help them mail it, or if you turn it in person, there should be some kind of certification of you are helping this person because they have a disability. Some kind of language like that. That one's rejected. The second one was just if you drop it off in person at a clerk's office, you should have to do some kind of certification of I am helping somebody because of X. That was rejected. The guidance approved 4-2 basically has no limits on how many ballots you can return, has no requirement for identification or certification in there, and Bob Spindell, a GOP appointee, complained, you're opening the door back up to ballot harvesting. There's no limit now on somebody perhaps trying to play with the rules to return a bunch of ballots for people. What I want to know is, are we going back to court? Remember, this all stems from the Dropbox lawsuit that the conservative Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty filed challenging the use of Dropboxes. The Supreme Court upheld a lower court ruling that drop boxes are not allowed. In that decision from the federal judge, the will said, we don't disagree with your interpretation of the law when it comes to assistance for disabled voters. We, however, would like to recommend to you, Commission, Election Commission, that you require some kind of certification, something attesting that these guys are doing something. Now, during the hearing for the Elections Commission, Dem members said, look, we don't have requirements like that right now. Like I said, oh, wait, but we have them for if you vote absentee. You have to sign the back of your envelope. A witness has to sign your absentee ballot envelope, right? Dem said, aha, but that's spelled out in state law. There's no requirement in state law explicitly saying if you are a disabled voter getting help, you have to do an additional step. We shouldn't be doing this. So that was the back and forth. What I'm wondering is will go to court and say, look, there's no requirement here for certification. They're leaving a loophole out there for X, Y, and Z. Or does Will say there are bigger fish to fry with our next topic, which is about whether you're going to have ballot curing going on this fall?
Way to transition there, JR, to the next topic. Yes, exactly what we're talking about. There was a Waukesha County judge that ordered the Wisconsin Elections Commission to rescind its 2016 guidance that allowed clerks to fill in missing information on ballot envelopes. Well, they can't do that anymore. And this, again, comes another ruling, another decision, very close to an election. Mm-hmm. I believe we're 9 weeks away from the November general election. Let's hear from the Waukesha County judge a little bit about why he made the decision.
The issue before the court is not whether a specific address on a certification is incomplete, missing, or even whether ballots with missing addresses on certifications should be counted. The issue is whether Wisconsin law authorizes clerks to insert address information in the witness certification on an absentee ballot, and if not, whether the guidance WEC provides mandating such actions can be tolerated. The court has concluded that Wisconsin law does not authorize election officials to correct, modify, alter, add to an absentee ballot certification. WEC cannot continue to promulgate advice it knows or should know violates state law and the intent of the legislature. It is of little wonder that proponents from all corners of the political spectrum are critical, cynical, and suspicious of how elections are managed and overseen when three unelected bureaucrats can defy the legislature and decline to suspend guidance that the Joint Committee under its oversight authority has determined violates Wisconsin law.
This has also been a long-standing issue with Republicans that you can't correct absentee ballots once they're at the clerk's offices. Of course, this was a big issue in 2020 as well, and it might be an answer for now, but are we going to see another challenge about this?
So two things. One, the use of absentee ballots is dropping significantly from where it was in 2020. We're nowhere near where we were before. If you look at the elections this spring, the August election is down from where it was in 2020 for obvious reasons, right? Concerns about COVID are starting to drop. We're going back to their normal activities, but we still have elevated levels of absentee voting versus pre-2020. The questions I have are, one, how many absentee ballots will we cast in November? And two, have we become proficient enough at it that we don't have these mistakes of leaving off a zip code or a street on your address as a witness? So that's the big thing. In this case, some of the parties asked the judge to stay his decision so they could appeal it. He denied that motion from the bench, but said, I'll have a hearing on Tuesday, I believe, to hear a formal motion. There is a time crunch here because he also gave the Elections Commission, I believe, until Wednesday to issue, basically to comply with his ruling. So there's a very narrow window to get him to either stay the decision or not, and then for the Elections Commission to act. Oh, by the way, we could go to the state Supreme Court with this one or the appeals court first, we shall see. And we're within 60 days, roughly, of an election. One of the questions that came up during the hearing was, what is status quo? Is the status quo allowing clerks to cure missing information, or is the status quo state law, which the judge interprets as saying you can't do this? So that what he's saying is they broke the status quo in 2016 by allowing this to happen. That's a foundational question of whether you grant a stay in a court case. So that'll be interesting to watch on Tuesday and see if that decision is stayed. And for clerks, poor clerks, they are now trying to figure out what they're supposed to do. Absentee ballots, I believe, are due to local clerks in 2 weeks. Then they must be sent out to local clerks by the next day, so they can be sent out to those who have a valid absentee ballot request on record. So we're in a time crunch right now because they start coming back quickly, and you could have a processing question of, are all ballots being treated equally this fall?
And ballot carrying was a Republican bill that we saw, mm-hmm. of one of the several that Governor Tony Evers vetoed. So Republicans have attempted to do many of these things that we're talking about today to get them into state law. But that's the challenge, of course, why Governor Evers is standing in the way of these changes. And that's one big issue in the governor's race. If mm-hmm. Wisconsin elects a Republican governor, Tim Michaels, things could change. Sticking with elections, there was a dramatic courtroom appearance by the man named Harry Waite, who is the Racine County man who openly admitted to committing voter fraud and requesting absentee ballots for elected officials and other people, claiming that he wanted to do it and did it and would do it again to expose what he calls vulnerabilities in the election system, specifically the My Vote system. So Waite, I was in the courtroom. He held an event outside with supporters, kind of comparing himself to the founding fathers of this nation and arguing, you know, they were, you know, they committed crimes back in the day. Here's my argument. They committed tyranny and they stood up against justice. So that happened first. Then Waite showed up about 17 minutes late to his court appearance because there's a courthouse and then across the street is where there's another courtroom hearing. You can immediately see that the judge was a little upset. So I would say things got off on the wrong foot. With this hearing, in the end, Waite initially was just issued a signature bond of $2,500. He signed that. Seemed like everything was over. It was a pretty quick court hearing. Then Waite spoke to the media shortly afterwards, which upset the judge quite a bit. There was a little altercation there. And then he had to re-sign another signature bond that included a gag order saying, hey, please do not talk to the media. Actually, you're not allowed to talk to the media about this case because he doesn't want it to be litigated in the press. Waite then goes outside the courtroom and continues talking to the press. There were sheriffs involved trying to gather him and find him. He almost got thrown in jail, I will say. So it was a very lively courtroom. But this is what Waite has been waiting for. Mm-hmm. It's kind of funny how I said that. He's wanted his day in court. He's openly admitted what he did. And we're going to talk later in the show about what he might do next at his next court appearance. But, you know, this is something that he's been, you know, almost promoting for a very long time. And it's an issue that I don't think is going to go away with him.
His supporters are selling T-shirts outside the building for $20 a piece for Harry's legal defense fund.
Free Harry is what they said.
So there's a little bit of a circus-like atmosphere to that, which a judge probably is not going to appreciate. It's going to be fascinating to see how somebody who openly admitted to doing something illegal, he knows is illegal, and then how he gets out of that, if he can get out of it.
Right. And this is so rare that the DOJ is stepping in to prosecute election fraud, because usually this is handled at a local level. Mm-hmm. DAs usually handle these cases. I kind of talked to a few at the state prosecutor's office. Usually it's just a fine. You're not really facing jail. I mean, yes, you can face jail time, but not a lot of people are actually thrown in jail for committing this. But since he's admitted and is promoting it with his organization, it's just so different. And it's something we'll keep an eye on. He's due back in court on September 19th. Mm-hmm. Transitioning from elections to education. A continuation of Governor Evers' reelection pitch is, I'm the education governor. It was a few weeks ago that he proposed $90 million in federal funding that will go to schools. And that came as classes just opened their doors this week. Some started last week as well. So his new proposal this week was, here's my budget request. Here's what I want to do with schools if I'm reelected. That's the kind of, yes, you're proposing this, but it only will maybe work if you're reelected. So here's what it will do. It's about a $2 billion increase for public schools. It would increase revenue limits by $350 per pupil in 2023 to 2024, and then $650 per pupil in the following years, 2025, 2026. About $240 million would be spent on mental health services, and $750 million over the biennium would be spent on special education. These numbers, you know, we've seen these proposals before. He's tried every single budget to increase education spending. He hasn't had much luck with the Republican-controlled legislature. Let's first take a listen from Governor Evers, and we'll kind of dive more into the likelihood of this even happening.
The good news is that we have a $5 billion projected surplus, which we can afford to make the investments our kids and our schools need and deserve without raising property taxes. And that's why I'm so excited to be here today to be kicking off this first day of school here in Milwaukee with a new back-to-school announcement. I've always said what's best for our kids is what's best for our state, and today we're announcing a plan to do just that. Budgets are about priorities, and that's why building the next budget, our biennial budget, begins, as it always does for me, what's best for our kids. So today, as kids across Wisconsin are kicking off a new school year, State Superintendent of Public Instruction, Dr. Underley, and I are announcing some of our shared priorities in the K-12 education budget that I will be including in my 2023-25 biennial budget.
Well, this may be an attractive proposal. It still would have to go through the legislature. It would only happen if he gets reelected. Mm-hmm. And also, there was a lot of school admins that say, hey, this is great. And they've long argued about the 0% increase in revenue limits in the current state budget is why they can't afford, you know, new school supplies, you know, pay for more teachers, and increase their salaries. So this is attractive to them, but we've known since he's been governor that he's tried to do this, and almost every time is rejected by Republicans.
Keep in mind this. This is not the full DPI proposal. This is basically the heart of it. There's more to come. Sparsity aid was $55 million in the last and this current biennium, that's not part of this proposal yet. Bilingual aid, you can go down the list of like all these other pots of money in education that they haven't talked about, nor have they laid out their proposal for the voucher program, school choice. And Republicans want to go, many of them want to go to a universal school choice system, which means everybody, regardless of income, would get a voucher to go to whatever school they want to, state of Wisconsin. This is gonna face a tough fight if Evers is reelected. It's also not the full enchilada of what he wants to do for education just yet. So more to come.
And we're just going to quickly mention President Joe Biden's visit on Monday at Milwaukee's Labor Fest. Basically a lot of the same rhetoric, just a little bit turned down from mm-hmm. speeches that he's been going around the nation talking about how democracy is at risk. Republican, the MAGA Republican is destroying democracy, et cetera, et cetera. But I think what we talked about on the show last week is what we got, right? Evers with a picture with President Biden up there, but there was one notable individual who was not there, which is Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes, who's running for U.S. Senate. His campaign said, yes, they support his trip, but he wasn't there, and he kind of got some flack for not showing up.
So I asked a lot of people about this week. I don't think the average voter, from my impression of talking to people, this is going to matter to him or her whether Barnes showed up for an event that Joe Biden did. However, it creates a narrative in the chattering class, people like you and I, about the fact he's not showing up to Biden's event, or he got to Labor Fest before Biden got there and got out of town before he took the stage, and that there's this perception that Barnes is not fully engaging the media when he's out in public. We've gone to events where they say he has no time for questions. He took a few up in Green Bay this week, said, hey, I had a packed schedule on Monday. It just feeds this narrative of, are they trying to shield him from something, prevent him from having a slip-up, or what is going on? It also places that much more of an emphasis on the debates that are coming up. We'll see how many they do. For him to perform well in that, because if you can't, you know, engage the media, or you're not willing to engage the media, and then you don't do well in a debate, it raises questions about how ready you are for the U.S. Senate.
All right. Let's move on to stocks picks. This week, a little shakeup in the state Supreme Court race. We have a new former justice, I guess, throwing his hat back in, who lost in 2020.
So conservative Daniel Kelly, we knew this has been coming for months that he's going to announce, just the time when he was going to do it. He is getting in. Now it's a three-person field. There is still time for somebody else to get in. The filing deadline is early January. For conservatives, Kelly is likely going to be your candidate, your choice come the February primary. He is going to probably have money behind him. Rebecca Bradley, who is an influential figure in conservative legal circles, she is a big fan of Daniel Kelly's, so expect her to support him. Your question really is then, which of the left of center candidates will get through the primary in February? You have Janet Petrovich from Milwaukee County, Everett Mitchell from Dane County. So you have kind of this Dane County versus Milwaukee County thing, right? They are the two drivers of Democratic votes in any election. Dane County for Everett is a turnout machine, whatever election it is. He's trying to be the first elected black justice in Wisconsin history. former Governor Jim Doyle appointed Lewis Butler to the court. He lost his retention bid about a decade or so ago, 15 years ago. So there's that. Janet fits the mold of like what's worked for progressives lately, a tough on crime, sitting judge, former prosecutor, and has personal money she can put in. They both have some downsides. Actually, all three of them do. Kelly lost in 2020 and lost by more than 10 points. Now, there was a Democratic primary for president. Still, it wasn't over, but it had just enough life left to drive Dems to the polls in April of 2020. That, plus some other things, like Kurowski's background, helped Joe Kurowski win that race. So will donors get behind him after he's only lost once? For Everett, there is, for example, a story in 2020, post-George Floyd, leading a protest in Madison, chanting, "No justice, no justice, no peace, no racist police." Okay, that fits an attack ad for conservatives. He also, when he's working for UW, advocated against prosecuting shoplifting. Probably also fits an attack ad. Janet was a prosecutor under John Chisholm in Milwaukee County. He's been a lightning rod among conservatives, so you can see that in an attack ad. So there's all kinds of pluses and minuses for these guys. And then for progressives, there is this kind of discussion going on of, do we want to keep doing that tough on crime liberal, essentially, like a Kurowski, like a Jill Dallet, who won in, or Becca Dallet, who won in 2018. It's worked, but we're post George Floyd. There's been this kind of social justice movement. Is that what they want as progressives now, or they want it more toward somebody like Everett, who's part of the social justice movement, saying we need a different approach to criminal justice, period, especially when it comes to some of these issues? So yeah. It's going to be a fascinating three-way race.
It's going to be interesting to see those strategies going forward, too, or if someone else enters the race as well. The primary will be in February. All right, we got about 5 minutes left. Let's get to mixed. About another write-in campaign for the 6th Assembly District, and this comes as there's been some drama, I guess, in general about the candidate that won the primary.
So Dee Neubert lost the six-way Republican primary by 71 votes. This is a deep red district. It's in northeastern Wisconsin, kind of like west of Green Bay, Shawano County, kind of centered of it. Worry for the Republican Assembly campaign committee right now. It should be like off the table. They have to worry about it. The question is, can Neubert win a writing campaign, or could he split the vote enough to open the door for a Democrat to win that seat? Now, again, plus 28 Republican seats, split a lot, but Peter Schmidt, former Shawano County supervisor, he won the primary even though he's convicted in 2019 of choking an employee on his family farm. People I talked to up in Shawano County said, look, we never thought he was going to win the primary. So we didn't really kind of do much because we thought he was going to lose. But he outspent Neubert 3-1, roughly, did a ton of doors, and kind of earned the victory in a six-way race. The question is, what do Republicans do now? Shawano County GOP, for example, they are all behind Dean. They are not going to support Peter Schmidt. They are keeping a distance from him. Other county parties I've talked to are taking more of an offhand approach. We're just staying out of this kind of thing. For Dean, you have to have infrastructure to pull this off. You're talking about getting 12, 14,000 write-in votes to be successful. Just throwing some numbers out there, just kind of guessing. That's a lot of people to write your name in. You need infrastructure. Does he have the donors involved? Does he have Shawano County GOP is going to do stuff for him, but will others do enough to help him? For Peter Schmidt, you know, is just being the R on the ballot enough? People are going to know more about this incident in 2019. It's going to get more attention now. Is that going to be enough to hurt you? And for the Democrat, like, is there a window? Is there a way to sneak through there if the split is big enough to win? And what does RAC do? Are they going to just kind of like hang back?
Right.
Because if they bet on the wrong horse and the other guy wins, you have a difficult situation with your caucus. Do they go back Peter Schmidt, even though the locals have disowned him, essentially? It's unlike anything I've seen in a long time.
Right. And just speaking of write-ins, we got to quickly mention Joel Jacobson, Democrat, is entering the race, the 63rd, against Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. He's now a write-in. We already know Adam Steen is a write-in, who lost narrowly to Voss. And Joel Jacobson has lost to Voss by
twice.
Kind of a landslide.
Big time.
More write-ins, and I think we'll learn more. And I think I know you're trying to get some research on when's the last time a write-in campaign won in Wisconsin. That's going to be pretty interesting. All right, we only got a few seconds left. We did talk about Harry Waite. Harry Waite is falling this week. Because I mean, he's facing 13 years in prison. But what is he going to do? I asked him after court, are you going to plead guilty? And he said yes. So I guess, are we going to trial or not? It's very wonky. And I just don't think, since he doesn't have legal representation right now, I don't know if he will, what he will do next.
How do you beat a charge when you've admitted that you did what's illegal? So a couple options. Well, if he pleads guilty, that's going to negate everything. But if he goes to trial, there's a theory called jury nullification where you convince the jurors what you did was should not be punished for it because it was some greater good. Racine County is a hotbed of Tea Party activity, has been for a long time. You get one or two of those like-minded folks in the jury, maybe. Do you argue the laws are not properly applied to you? Maybe. There's not a clear path for him to beat this, and it is he's already irritated the judge. It is more like a political rally than it is a court hearing. So I don't know he's got a lot of friends right now on the bench because of how he's behaving so far and how he's approaching this. It's a very cavalier attitude, people told me, of, yeah, I did it, I'd do it again. Mm-hmm. That's not going to help you in a criminal trial when you are facing two felony counts and two misdemeanors.
All right, well, that will do it for this week. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
We'll see you next week.
This program was brought to you from Wisconsin Eye's Margaret Farrow Studio.